So, hello everybody and welcome back to a new lecture in overheating, an anthropology of accelerated change. So, we've been talking about mining, about waste, about cities and about a number of other things during this course, and today we're going to talk about one of the most striking, again, I'm repeating myself, a very striking aspect of the life in the overheated world, namely that of the destabilization of culture, or you might say the new form of dynamic around culture. There are a number of things that I need to say about this before we get properly started. One is that culture is not the same as identity. To put it very briefly, identity, social identities tend to be discontinuous, in the sense that either you're a member of a group or you're not. Yes, there are hybrids. Yes, there are intermediaries. There are people who don't fit in, and there are anomalies in any identity group who are sort of a bit inside and a bit outside. By all means, these people exist. But on the whole, there is a drive to boundedness. And keep in mind that the most influential, probably most influential book on ethnicity in anthropology is called Ethnic Groups and Boundaries, edited by Frederick Barth in 1969. And the book that I'm showing you now is one of the fruits of the overheating projects, called Identity Destabilized. We do talk about cultural dynamics, we do talk about changes in culture, but mainly we talk about the way in which people identify with groups. And those are not the same things. You know, there may be a lot of cultural variation within any group with a shared identity, in terms of accent, in terms of values, even in terms of religion and the fairly fundamental aspects of who you are, and yet you feel that you belong to the same group. And likewise, there may be a lot of cultural similarities or cultural continuities between different, as it were, identity groups, groups which conceptualize themselves as being different. I mean, think about football supporters who support different football teams. They, from the outside, they look pretty much the same, don't they? They support their teams in pretty much the same ways, and yet they have very distinct identities, to the extent that on certain match days it would be a very bad idea for a Tottenham supporter and an Arsenal supporter to watch the big game together. So a culture is not continuous, sorry, discontinuous in the same way as identities. It's much more continuous, it's much more flowing, it's harder to grasp, it's even very hard to define, as you would know. We think of culture today in anthropology not in terms of a stock of values, traditions, etc., that the group has in common, but rather as that which makes communication possible, that which makes it possible to understand each other. Not in the sense that we have everything in common, but in the sense that we somehow share a world within which we can voice our disagreements. And this world is now being shared increasingly in an overheated globalized world in new ways, and transcontinentally, across boundaries. It can be said in many cases that, you know, any person in some part of Oslo with a particular kind of orientation and particular set of interests has more in common with similarly minded people in Trinidad or the United States or South Africa than he or she would with their neighbors in certain important respects. In other respects, they may have more in common with their neighbors. So it's not, culture is not an either or thing. As the psychological anthropologist Anthony Wallace said as early as the 1960s, quoted approvingly by many, including Ulf Hannes, who's written a lot about cultural complexity, culture is not about the replication of similarity, it is about the organization of diversity. So keep that in mind. Culture is a slippery term, and we should be wary of using it in the plural form, as in cultures, because then we may fall into the trap of essentialism, or freezing cultural worlds as though they were homogeneous inside and with clear boundaries to the outside. So, having said this, let me move back in history, as I have done a few times during these lectures, and talk a bit about the cultural dynamics in early modernity. Some would say And maybe I actually said that once. Others have surely also said it, that in a certain sense, Columbus was the first modern person in the world, in the sense that he stumbled. He was a man of the Middle Ages in many ways, reading the Bible, you know, as a kind of manual in order to navigate the new world. And he believed, possibly till the day of his death, that he had actually reached India. But he stumbled into the new world without being aware of what he did, because he had conquered, or rather, he hadn't really conquered much, but he had discovered for the Europeans a part of the world that had not been described in the Bible, which is even today sometimes spoken of as the New World. And in the aftermath of the conquest, there was a huge, you know, mobility, okay, of people, some of it voluntary, migration to New Spain and so on, basically voluntary people who were keen to or determined to make a good life for themselves in the new colonies. But many were forced, right? There was a lot of enforced migration, especially from Africa, not exclusively, but especially from Africa through the slave trade, through the transatlantic slave trade, which has had enormous consequences for the contemporary world by creating an Afro-diasporic world, I would say. I'm not saying group, I'm not saying culture, but an Afro-diasporic world which has impacted and influenced the contemporary world in many ways. I'm not here talking about indigenous groups that lived in the Americas before Columbus. That falls slightly outside of the theme for this lecture, but it is surely an important topic for anthropology, not least described and studied by Eric Wolff in his historical anthropology. So, Creolization, the world of the Creole, is in some ways, it's a precursor to the kind of cultural world in which we live today, where various influences, various strands of influence mix in new ways, where new cultural universes or revised or changed or mixed cultural universes are being created as a result of increased contact between groups, right? And increased communication. Doesn't even have to be contact within groups these days because of contemporary information and communication technology. So Creolization, the Creole, a very difficult, I mean, as many words. You know, the philosopher Nietzsche once said that only words with no history can be defined accurately. So Creole has a lot of history, a lot of historical baggage, and it means different things in different parts of the world where it is used locally in the vernacular. The criollo in New Spain, in the Spanish-speaking, Spanish-conquered colonies in South and Central America, the criollo in the 16th century and later was defined as a person of European descent who was born in the colonies. So that was the criollo. In Louisiana, in the United States, it was used in a comparable way. People of French descent were known as Creoles. However, in other parts of the world, a Creole, is a descendant of the plantation system. It's someone who has a history connecting them, usually to slavery and to the plantation system. In Mauritius, Creoles are simply people of African Malagasy or mixed origin, mixed African and something else origin, whereas others have, you know, other labels. I think in terms of groups. In La Réunion, which is the neighboring island to Mauritius, which is still a French département, it's still a part of France, although it's located on the other side of the equator. In La Réunion, a Creole is someone who was born in La Réunion, as opposed to the Zouriol, the people who have migrated there, usually from metropolitan France. So a Creole in Réunion could be a white person, a mixed person, you know, anyone who is born in a colony. In the Caribbean, Creole is used in the way usually resembling the Mauritian usage more than others. But there are exceptions. I mean, in Trinidad, the term French Creole is still being used in a way similar to that in Louisiana, in the American South. So French Creole is a person of European descent, and usually of French descent. They don't speak French anymore. I mean, they stopped speaking French about a century ago. But they're still spoken of as French Creoles. So it's a tricky concept, the Creole. Creolization is, on the face of it, less tricky. Creolization is a word which derives from linguistics. It's mainly still used in linguistics, mostly used in linguistics. And creolization is the emergence of new languages which become mother tongue, which are mother tongue to people as a result of contact between groups which have no common language. So linguistic creolization happened in all of these plantation colonies in the Caribbean and in the Indian Ocean, and it has happened elsewhere as well. New vernacular everyday languages, new mother tongues emerging out of that encounter. The slaves came from different backgrounds in Africa, and in some colonies there was a conscious policy not to allow people from the same ethnic group or the same tribe to live together in order for them not to be able to organize resistance. So they had to create a new language from scratch. And this is why the Caribbean is perhaps the first truly modern part of the world. Something new had to be created. One could no longer rely on tradition. Tradition was half forgotten. Your social system had been eradicated. Your kinship system, your political system, your mode of subsistence, all of this was left behind. Some remained, some was transformed, some of the skills, some of the beliefs, some of the ways of going about things, but on the whole, new cultural worlds and social forms of organization had to be created from scratch on the plantation and afterwards. So Creole languages emerged. You may have heard of pidgin languages. That's a different kind of thing. A pidgin language, I mean, for a long time, it was believed that pidgins eventually might evolve into Creoles. A pidgin language is a contact language which is more rudimentary, it's more basic, it has a smaller vocabulary, a less complex grammar than the Creole, and it is not the mother tongue of anyone. It's a kind of a kind of language which is just made up in order to facilitate trade in most places. So pidgins typically emerged and appeared in trading ports. Recent research argues, and I think convincingly, that pigeons generally don't evolve into Creoles. Pigeons are spoken by adults who carry out some kind of business together. In the far northeast of Norway, you had until the Russian Revolution a pigeon language called the Russenorsk, Russo-Norwegian, which had a vocabulary of upwards of maybe 400 words, enabling people to trade in, you know, timber, grains, fish, vodka and other things, and maybe to gossip a little bit, but not more than that, adults. Whereas Creole languages typically emerged on plantations, in plantation societies, and were first spoken probably by children. So they immediately, or very soon, became the mother tongue. And there's documentation for this in some ways. I mean, there are some old novels from Mauritius. There's one famous one called Paul et Virginie, Paul and Virginia, which is a love story from Mauritius. And the author had actually been to Mauritius, and he had collected a bit of material, he had taken notes, and there are snippets of dialogue in that book, which are quite, I wouldn't say identical, but quite similar to and perfectly comprehensible to a contemporary speaker of Mauritian Creole from the 18th century, you know, more than 200 years ago. Excuse me. So, Creole, now, but that's the linguistic creolization. In anthropology, we sometimes have transposed this idea of linguistic creolization to the realm of culture, exploring to what extent similar processes take place in cultural worlds to that of creolization. And one of the leading proponents of this view is the aforementioned Ulf Hannes, who wrote a very influential article back in the 1980s called The World in Creolization, where he argues that, in fact, the whole world owing to these crossroads and meeting places where migrants come, you know, where there are, you know, railway stations and little coffee shops and businesses of various kinds, and migrants come in from various parts of the country, even of the world, that cultural creolization takes place in the way comparable to that which happened on the plantation in Caribbean islands and elsewhere. So for a very long time, the Caribbean was held in low esteem by anthropologists. It wasn't really interesting because those people who lived there, they didn't have a traditional culture, you know, and they were the product of modernity and so on. So they were less exciting than people in some hilly area which had hardly been contacted by the Europeans before. This changed in the 1980s and 90s when it was discovered that in fact the Caribbean represents historically perhaps a vanguard of a particular form of cultural modernity which is based on novelty, creation of something new, because the old has to be abandoned. A kind of post-traditional society and of a cultural dynamic where mixing is seen as a source of wealth and not as a problem, depending on the kind of mixing, of course. You know, it's not as if Creole societies are open to everything, but there is an openness to change which you know, captured the interest of many anthropologists in the 1980s and 90s, because they then saw processes for globalization elsewhere and needed an analytic toolbox and some comparative horizons in order to make sense of what they saw. Right, and I'm one of those anthropologists. Did fieldwork in and worked with the Indian Ocean and the Caribbean and other, you know, Creole peoples for a very long time. So I have a strong personal and existential interest in this as well. Another footnote. Let's move on. So this image, you can see that in fact the emergence of Creole society, if we think about it as one of the Afro-diasporic societies, which I think we can for now, it was not a tea party. It was not a breeze. It was not a pleasure. They have a history which is marked by and scarred by massive violence, enforced displacement, humiliation, and very hard work, and very often very short lifespans. So the miracle of creolization, now this is from a maize plantation somewhere in the American South, I think. There are palm trees at the back, but what you see in the front there is clearly not sugarcane, so it must be, and it's not cotton, so it must be maize. The miracle of creolization has been described by Richard Price and by Michel Rolf Trouillon, who was a very, really good anthropologist with a background from Haiti, who worked in the United States. Richard Price still around, lives with his wife in Martinique, French-speaking Caribbean, and both of them describe the miracle of creolization. And what is that? What's a miracle? Well, I would say that the miracle of creolization, I'm now just using my own words to describe the same insight that you find in Trouillon and Price, that it is a miracle that this culture of suffering and violence and humiliation and disruption and enforced change could lead to so much cultural creativity that has shaped and characterized so much of the modern world. That could be described in fact as a miracle. There is a cheerfulness about much of this culture, an optimism. So let me just rush you through some of this before we move on. Derek Walcott, a poet from and a playwright from St. Lucia, one of the small islands in the Caribbean, lived in Trinidad much of his life. So the Trinidadians are, you know, they're keen to sort of appropriate him as one of their own. He won a Nobel Peace Prize in 1992. And many of Walcott's poems, they circle around the themes of the ocean and identity and flows and that sort of thing. He was deeply influenced by Homer, the Odyssey, and so on. The Odyssey, which is, you know, a long epic poem that contributes, you know, defining Western literature about the seafaring Ulysses. And so to Walcott, the sea is a source of identity, not the land, because the sea is an open surface. It belongs to everyone and no one, and it's open-ended. So, Walcott. I could have mentioned V.S. Naipaul as well, Vidya Naipaul, a Trinidadian author, but he doesn't quite fit in. He is culturally creolized, but he resists it. He didn't like to be a creole. Okay, he was a descendant of Indian indentured laborers, you know, sugarcane laborers, who were brought to some of the sugar colonies after the end of slavery, such as Fiji, Mauritius, Natal in South Africa, Guyana in South America, and Trinidad. Large numbers of Indians from India. So he had to explain to people as a young man, I'm an East Indian from the West Indies. And they, you know, what does that mean? People had no idea that there had been any Indian migration. So Naipaul, he resisted that identity. He wasn't fond of it. He thought it was inauthentic, and tried to find ways of moving beyond it. And yet, I could have mentioned Naipaul, but now Walcott. Now this gentleman, Bob Marley, I mean the greatest star in reggae music, whose music has traveled the world. I mean, in Indonesia, in the Philippines, there are some rather good reggae bands, and without Bob Marley, they probably would not have existed. So he had a short but intense life, with a great deal of that sort of creativity. You find that in later music from Jamaica as well. I mean, dub, rap, house, all of this originates either in the studios in Kingston, Jamaica, or among in the Jamaican and Caribbean diaspora in Harlem, New York. So the creativity of Creoleness is, I could have gone on, and I'll go on a little bit more, okay? Favorite theme, the entire tradition of rhythmic popular music, you know, blues, ragtime at the time, jazz, rock, etc., a result of the Afro-diasporic impulse. And this image is of Robert Johnston, one of the pioneers in blues music, who had an even shorter life than Bob Marley and didn't record much, but who has left traces. You know, you can hear echoes of Robert Johnston in the music of Led Zeppelin and in much other rock. There was one form of enforced creolization in the American South which was particularly interesting and which I'd like to mention, just to illustrate, you know, the prehistory of the contemporary destabilization of culture that we see in the overheated globalized world. And that is the outcome of the Jim Crow laws. Jim Crow laws were introduced after the end of slavery and lasted in some states until the 1960s, until the civil rights movement. So it was a racist set of laws in the American South, which treated people differently depending on their origins and on who their parents were and what they looked like, on what Americans and others call race. So if you were black, you were, you know, not allowed to take buses with, you know, with white people and so on and so forth. But there was a category of middle class, highly educated, and sometimes quite well off people who were coloured. You know, they were a bit of this and a bit of that. Kind of people who in Mauritius are sometimes spoken of as gens de couleur, people of colour, neither black nor white, but a mix. Barack Obama, you know, American mother, Kenyan father. And in the Deep South, these people were then classified as black according to the one drop rule. The one drop rule. If there's just one drop of Negro blood in you, you're not one of us. So that means that if you have four grandparents, one of them was black, you considered black, or you were considered black. This would not be the case in the Caribbean, you know, where they had many different categories for describing the way people looked and where the boundaries were more fluid, as in Brazil. But in the United States, this was the case. This meant that middle-class people with a mixed ancestry, who had had piano lessons, for example, so they had learned how to read music, maybe even how to arrange music, were suddenly no longer allowed to perform with white artists and play in white clubs. So they had to play with black people. Right, so you got this sort of meeting, okay, between the high culture of the piano lessons and the rhythmic Afro-diasporic music of the streets in the late 19th century. This is a very convoluted story. And this meeting eventually led to the emergence of jazz. Right. The trumpet, the bass, the drums, plus the piano. Okay. So, Afro-diasporic culture. Just a few examples of the outcome of this enforced cultural meeting between different cultural traditions, not only between Europeans and Africans, but there were also others who were brought in. Different parts of Africa brought their own sort of ways of doing things, their own ideas, their own values, their own music, their own myths. And some of them have re-emerged in the Caribbean context, but been reshaped and remodeled and being revised. So in other words, your cultural world was considered as something fluid, which didn't have clear boundaries. Just as your social world, you could basically marry anyone, regardless of how they looked. Now this is a Creole, a big, big Creole family. You can see that there are some light-skinned, some dark-skinned people there. That was not really a big issue at the time. For them, but it was a big issue for majority Euro-America. Okay, and so the Creole world, it sits uneasily with identity politics because the Creole identity, in a sense, is open-ended. You know, it doesn't have clear boundaries. Unlike ethnic groups, unlike other groups, it doesn't have clear boundaries. You have people in the United States. I've now mentioned a couple in the text there. Beyoncé, who has a very mixed origin, also with some Native American bits, and Tiger Woods, who describes himself as a Cablinesian or something like that. I mean, he's a bit Caribbean, a bit African, a bit Indian, and so on. Very mixed. The golfer, the scandalous but very famous and very skilled golfer. So think about this. And the term miscegenation, which is a pejorative term to describe racial mixing as something dangerous and harmful and degenerative, which is still a widespread idea in many parts of the world and which we need to study anthropologically in order to understand what's going on, where it comes from. Well, Mary Douglas can help us, at least up to a point, by trying to understand where these ideas come from, because of her emphasis on the need for boundaries and the need for an inside and an outside, and the way in which, as I spoke about earlier, the way in which that which doesn't fit in is considered dangerous, and that which is outside is considered the other, beyond the pale, and so on. So there are some social processes at work here which create frictions, less so in the Caribbean than elsewhere. I mean, people in the Caribbean disagree about lots of things, and there's a lot of friction, but this is not one of them. And there are elements of pigmentocracy. I mean, if you look at the Seychelles, which is one of the societies I've engaged with a vast proportion of the population are Creole. I mean, they're of a slave or part slave origin. Most of the leading politicians are pretty light-skinned. I mean, they're not sort of European, but they're light-skinned, which means that they have Europeans in their fairly near ancestry. So, we move on now to a new approach, which builds on and is inspired by work on the Creole world and Creolization, namely the term superdiversity, which was coined less than 15 years ago by this gentleman, an anthropologist and research manager in Germany, but he's American with a Slovene name, okay? Steve Vertovec, or Vertovec, as they would call him in Slovenia, but he doesn't speak Slovene because he's American. So Steve Vertovec had discovered, around 2005 and so on, around 2005, he discovered that there was something new about the kind of social and cultural complexity that we saw in European cities. And he was in particular thinking about London, where he had done some research himself, London, England. It was no longer the case, as in the past, that you had certain settled minorities, most of them with a background in the British Empire. So you knew where the Bangladeshis were. They were in a particular part of the Tower Hamlets in East London. You knew where the Jamaicans were. They were in Brixton or in Notting Hill. You knew where the Indians were. They were in certain parts of South London and so on. And they all had a background, or they came from, or they grew out of the British Empire. But then he says that, you know, that sort of model no longer worked in the early 2000s because of acceleration. I'm calling it acceleration, but because of the increased diversity. And he said, you know, he was here. I mean, we know each other because we both worked in Trinidad and sort of stayed in touch for many years. He worked in Trinidad also, so he has that sort of gaze on the world of migration, also partly influenced by his work in the Caribbean. Although he wrote about Hindu Trinidad and I wrote about ethnic relations, we compared notes quite a bit. And so Steve Vertebeck was here, and he said that, you know, the situation now in a city like London is that you can't really tell where a particular, as it were, ethnic group lives, because it depends on a number of circumstances. Of the first, second, third generation, what's their educational level, you know, what's their family wealth, what are their interests, and so on. So they're scattered in a much greater extent. And not only that, so you can, that's one thing, they're scattered to a much greater extent. Secondly, the largest new migrant groups in Britain had no background, they had no connection to the empire. They had nothing to do with the British Empire. They didn't come from ex-colonies. I mean, we didn't find that dramatic in Norway, because the ethnic minorities who live here, or the people who have parents or grandparents from other parts of the world, obviously did not belong to the Norwegian Empire either. But, you know, he said, I mean, the largest new groups, they might be Iraqis, and there might be, you know, various other. So he says that, I mean, not only do they come from non-empire places, like, you know, Iraq and South America and so on, but you can also not predict from looking at someone. They have Pakistani origin. You can't really tell anything about their life worlds. Some of them might be very British in their outlook. Some of them might be very conservative in their outlooks. You know, in terms of, for example, religion, kinship, and so on, it's very hard to tell. You cannot say that the Pakistani in Britain practice arranged marriage. Yeah, I mean, some do, and some don't. So, and in addition, the new forms of diversity come in. Diversity associated with sexual orientation, with your cultural interests, your values, your ideas. Certain people who belong to different political groups in a country like Britain would not, you know, be on easy speaking terms with each other. So, as he says, and I mean, I'm sort of quoting Steve Vertebeck from memory. In the past, people came from a few places and went to a few places. We're now talking about the post-war, mainly migration from the south to the north, including places like Norway. Remember this, that migration to Norway has also grown very much, and it's also diversified. There were a few groups in the beginning, few national, as it were, groups from Pakistan, mainly from Punjab in Pakistan, and from Turkey at the very beginning. Increasingly, other minority groups have come in, Somalis, Tamils from Sri Lanka, and so on. And by now, by far the largest non-Norwegian minority are the Poles, people from Poland, who were a small minority here before 2004. So in the past, people came from a few places and went to a few places. Nowadays, people come from lots of places and go to lots of places. That's a sort of a short version of what one aspect of super diversity is about. But he also speaks of the diversification of diversity. I mean, I've spoken about the acceleration of acceleration. He speaks of the diversification of diversity, because it becomes more fine-grained. It becomes less group-based. You get the kind of diversity that you cannot put down to this group and that group, and the Vietnamese are such, and, you know, the Thais are such. No, you can't, because it sometimes has to be studied in different ways. So when I carried out I directed some research in Eastern Oslo on super diversity. We did look at ethnicity. I mean, we looked at place. How do people relate to the place where they live, right? Because that seemed to us much more sensible, because ethnicity wouldn't be able to generate that sort of answers, contrary to what many people believe. ethnicity is less important. It's exaggerated in many cases. It's not unimportant. I'm not saying that, but it's less important. By ethnicity, by the way, I don't mean the same thing as what you sometimes see in the newspapers, where ethnicity is more or less synonymous with race. Ethnicity is about origins. So people from Poland have a different ethnic identity to people from Bergen. Okay. Linguistic superdiversity. Jan Blommert writes really well about this. He's one of the people in the sort of circle of researchers who studies superdiversity. And Blommert is he's a Belgian sociolinguist who writes about globalization and language and works in the Netherlands. So you could say, don't quote me on this, you could say he gets the best of both worlds. Belgian food and Dutch bureaucracy. Well, it's not everything runs smoothly, you know, efficiently and so on. But don't quote me on that. So he lives in Antwerp and works in Tilburg in the Netherlands and has looked at linguistic superdiversity. You know, the way in which new forms of mixing, not really Creole, but phenomena resembling creolization of language take place in cities where people meet, where you get a real sort of mix of languages. I mean, in Norwegian, we have the term which has been used sometimes, kebabnorsk. Kebab Norwegian, which is a way of talking about a certain form, a certain way, a certain multi-ethnolect of Norwegian, typically associated with complex places. And it's not as if only people with a non-Norwegian background speak with that sort of version of Norwegian. I mean, people of Norwegian origin do as well if they grow up in the same areas. So with various loan words, with certain syntactical changes, word order change, that kind of thing. So Jan is really good at this. I can see from my notes that I also said something. I was going to say something about language and scaling. I'll wait until after the break because I think we now need a break. This is a really nice book, edited by Jan Blommert and a few colleagues. So let's take a break and we'll return to talking about destabilized culture afterwards. But one thing first, I'll leave the last slide, and this is about scale. And it's not just about language. Just have a look at this, the contrast. This is very much about the way in which anthropology works, isn't it? And anthropologists work. The local and the global. The particular and the universal. And in linguistic registers, we find both. You know, some people would speak in a very concrete, very direct way. Others would speak in a very abstract and general way. This is partly to do with a social background, with the class, with their educational level, but also, says Jan Blommert, it also has to do with where they come from, or where their parents come from, right? So linguistic scales are brought to bear on that particular form of complexity as well. Okay, now I said something about scale, but have a look at this. I think it's very useful as a way to begin thinking about a certain form of complexity. Okay, see you in a little while.